For the benefit of those who are working with the equipment, you had better turn this up good and loud, because my voice is just teetering on the ragged edge of disappearing. those of you who are also taking the Monday night course, recall that I described my plague at that time, and you can see the effect of this as of tonight. Tonight, we're dealing with the question of the historical soundness of the Christian position. In the sessions that we have had up to this point, we've been talking about various philosophies and theologies of history, and we've attempted to determine the problems that exist in these approaches. We're now at the point where we are beginning to ask the question as to the validity of the Christian approach to history. And tonight we're going to spend our time strictly on the historical material relative to the picture of Jesus that we have. We are going to put philosophical questions in regard to the miraculous, for example, aside until next week, when we deal with the issue of miracle in relation to history. And then finally, at our last session, we'll be dealing with the application of this material to general questions of philosophy of history. Last time we talked a bit about the historical philosophy of Erich Weigelin. In The Shape of the Past, in chapter 5, there is a dialogue translated from the French where Weigelin discussed the issue of the validity of his Christian view of history with a Marxist historian, a very well-known Marxist philosopher of history, Lucian Goldman. It'll be useful in beginning this discussion of the historical claims that Christianity makes for the validity of its philosophy of history, just to go over this debate briefly. And if you have the book with you, this is on pages 136 and 137. Goldman begins by criticizing Weigelin. Goldman: Mr. Weigelin regards the appearance of messianisms, the appearance of what Weigelin calls metastatic gnosis, in Marxism the attempt to establish a perfect society here on earth through equity in the ownership of the means of production in society. Mr. Weigelin regards the appearance of messianisms as a kind of regression or decadence or departure from reality, in quotes. I should like to know the basis of such a value judgment. For in a word, one could regard the messianic attitude as natural, and conversely, the idea of transcendence, the idea of a transcendent God, as a decadent phenomenon. Now, this is throwing the gauntlet down. Why should Weigelin think that his particular conception is the basic or fundamental one, and that the Marxist denial of transcendence, for example, and a philosophy of history based on this, is derivative and unfortunate? Well, Weigelin replies, I believe that my analysis is founded on objective criteria. Now, here we are waiting for the objective evidence, of course. Weigelin continues, I have defined reason as the maximum distance between realms of being, between immanence and transcendence. Cannot one say, in the most objective fashion, that from the moment one gives up this distinction between immanence and transcendence, one is regressing? Goldman, perhaps, but on condition that one first proves that several realms of being actually exist and that the transcendent is not simply an illusion. Point very well taken. It isn't enough for Weigelin to define reality in terms of transcendence and immanence and then say, you can only think straight if you use this kind of approach. Now the question is, what is the evidence for this kind of distinction? Vaglin. Historically, there is an experience of transcendence. Historically, people have experienced God. Goleman. There have been in history thousands of experiences which critical analysis is afterwards reduced to the level of illusions. When you yourself speak of what you call a gnosis, metastatic gnosis that we were talking about last time, you perform reductions of this kind. Socialistic messianism reflects a kind of religious experience, but a non-transcendental experience. A religious experience that does not involve God. Why should you take exception to it when it is as much a historical fact as the others? This also is well taken. There is, of course, in history, the experience of God by way of people believing in him, but there is also the experience of people not believing in God. Now, why should Vaglin say that belief and a philosophy of history grounded there is to be considered correct while the other is not? Vaglin answers, for an epistemological reason, that is for a reason connected with the meaning of truth, which seems to me entirely valid, because it, your messianism, is a derivative experience, not an original experience. Goleman, but right there I discern what I call a value judgment. Why isn't non-transcendental messianism, in his form, Marxism, the original form of religious experience, with the transcendental messianisms, the belief in God, merely the degenerate forms? Religion doesn't need to be connected with the idea of the supernatural. Now, in my opinion, as I've indicated in the book, Goldman comes out ahead in that little discussion. Why? Simply because Vaglin never offers concrete evidence for the philosophy of history that he presents. We discussed this philosophy of history last time, and it's a striking one. But the question is not how striking it is, really, but whether or not it's true. And this goes for the Christian view of history that we described in earlier sessions. What about this notion of the history of mankind, or the history of the world, beginning in creation and extending on to a last judgment and centering on the coming of God in the person of Christ? As striking as such a view is, this certainly doesn't establish its validity. Nor is its validity established by saying that other attempts to understand the meaning of history have three strikes against them to begin with. We pointed out in the case of the idealistic view of history maintained by Hegel and the materialistic view of history maintained by Marx, that in both of these cases, attempts are made to determine the total pattern without being able to stand outside of it. In both of these cases, the philosophers involved are within the flux of history and do not have the perspective necessary to determine the meaning of the whole. But the fact that they have three strikes against them doesn't automatically establish the Christian view of history. The Christian view is that within the sphere of historical experience, a word comes from outside. And this word from outside provides insight into the meaning of this experience, because this word is not limited or conditioned by the experience itself. Or, putting it in terms of the linear diagram, at a particular point of history, there is an entrance from the outside, and that entrance from the outside makes it possible to understand the totality. Now, to make this as a claim is one thing, to provide evidence for it is another. The evidence in behalf of the Christian philosophy of history is appropriately historical evidence. That is to say, whether or not... My goodness, what is this anyway? I wonder what you were doing trotting up and down over there. Oh, thank you. among the Borgias, one always had the person bringing the cup drink a little bit first. The Christian claim is that an entrance is made from outside history into it, providing an insight into the meaning of the historical drama. Now, this is, by its very nature, a historical claim. The question is simply whether or not this case can be maintained in terms of historical evidence. Either the man Jesus was the person that, according to the primary historical records, he claimed to be, or he isn't. And if he is not that person, if he is not the entrance of a word from outside the human situation into it, then the entire Christian philosophy of history, whether or not it is striking and interesting, simply is unable to be sustained. I want to emphasize this before I go into this evidence, because there is such a tendency on the part of people, particularly if they have had only vague contact with the Christian faith, to get the idea that the Christian claim is a kind of vague, emotional, if you will, faith claim, which in no sense depends on evidence. In other words, the Christian philosophy of history is accepted by people who like it, whereas other people who don't particularly like it will take other views. It's certainly true that many people do enter into their convictions on the basis of likes and dislikes. But this is not the way in which the Christian faith intends to operate. The Christian faith presents certain concrete evidences in behalf of its central affirmation that God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself, and on the basis of this, it calls for faith. This is faith grounded in evidence. It is not faith floating in midair. Now, what is the nature of this evidence? Again, if I can refer to the shape of the past, the evidence I have outlined in several points in the pages immediately following those that I was referring to before. On page 138 and 139, or if you don't have this with you, and you do have this mimeograph, The Quest for Absolutes, you'll find the material on pages 6, pages 5, actually 5 and extending over on 6 and following. The statements are virtually the same, though this mimeograph is a summary, really, of the material that comes in the book. Now, we're not going to take up all aspects of this argument tonight. We're going to be dealing with the philosophical aspects of it next time, as I mentioned before. But let me go through the argument and then take the historical considerations that are basic to it. The first is this. On the basis of accepted principles of textual and historical analysis, the gospel records, that is, this could be expanded to the New Testament materials, if you will, the gospel records or New Testament materials, are found to be trustworthy historical documents, primary source evidence for the life of Christ. Now that we're going to be concentrating on this evening. Secondly, in these records, Jesus exercises divine prerogatives and claims to be God in human flesh, and he rests his claims on his forthcoming resurrection. The third point, in all four Gospels, or in the New Testament materials, if you will, Christ's bodily resurrection is described in minute detail. Christ's resurrection evidences his deity. Point four is a philosophical consideration which we'll get into next time. The fact of the resurrection cannot be discounted on a priori philosophical grounds. Miracles are impossible only if one so defines them. But such definition rules out proper historical investigation. Now, if that is not clear to you, if you don't see what's going on in that particular point, this will be dealt with in a great deal of detail next time. Then, considerations 5 and 6, if Christ is God, then what he says is true concerning the Old Testament, concerning the forthcoming New Testament, and indeed concerning whatever he deals with. And this then comes down to the final consideration, that when he makes statements, or when statements are made biblically about the nature of history, these statements are apodictic truth, that is, these statements are indeed valid, and where they come into contradiction with other opinions in regard to the nature of history, the biblical opinions must be held to and the others rejected. Though this does not mean, of course, that where the biblical material does not bear upon other opinions dealing with the nature of history, that those opinions need to be thrown out. The end result of this is that if the historical case for Christ's deity stands, then Christ's judgment in regard to the nature of history also stands. Putting it irreverently, he had forgotten more about the nature of history than you'll ever know, or that I'll ever know. And under those circumstances, his view of the totality of it becomes normative for determining its significance. And this schema becomes established. Now, obviously, this case rests directly on point number one, namely, the validity, historically, of this picture of Jesus presented. In the discussions I've had with people, both formal and desultory, I have found that a common statement on this subject goes along these lines. How can anybody possibly consider all of that mythical stuff in the New Testament as having any historical worth? Why, everybody knows that this material was written centuries after the time of Jesus, and therefore it's the product of late tradition and does not have to be relied upon. Whenever this sort of statement is made, I think back to my beloved professor of logic at Cornell, Max Black, whom we used to call Black Max because of his personality, who used to say, whenever anyone begins a statement with "everybody knows" or "obviously," it isn't. And this turns out to be a device for smoke screening the situation in such a fashion that one doesn't ask the more particular questions. Namely, what kind of evidence do you have to support what everybody knows? The fact of the matter is that the materials that are collected in the New Testament and that appear in ever so sacred and holy red letter editions on India paper with verse numbers are not there in order to be walled off from historical analysis. It operates in exactly the other fashion. The materials got there in those India paper editions because of the value that they had as historical sources. If historical criteria are applied to these materials, which we apply to other documents, if the same criteria for attesting the validity of these materials, of other materials, are used to determine the value of these New Testament materials, an amazing result occurs. These documents turn out to be so well attested that if you want to get rid of them, if you want to throw them out of the pale of solid historical information, then, to be consistent, you have got to dump virtually all of the knowledge of the classical world you have And along with this, some very uncomfortable facts in post-classical history. These documents are the best attested documents of the Greco-Roman world. Now, how is a document attested? There are three tests that are applied to a document to determine the historical validity that ought to be attached to it. And these tests you can find set out in any work on historiography, on methodological historiography. They are not tests that are invented by theologians in order to justify the New Testament materials. They're tests which are employed whether you want to deal with the question of the New Testament materials or any other documents. In the first place, there is the bibliographical test. The bibliographical test. Secondly, there is the test of internal evidence, and secondly, the test of external evidence. The bibliographical test refers to the degree of accuracy with which the original text can be reconstructed, or the degree of accuracy with which our present texts represent the original document. In other words, the bibliographical test has to do with the textual tradition between the original writing and what we have today. Even if it were possible to say that a particular classical figure had written a particular work, if you had such a muddy textual tradition that what you have today could not necessarily be related to what he did, it wouldn't do you any good to know that he had written such a work. It becomes necessary, therefore, to be sure at the outset that the texts as you have them at the present time accurately represent what was originally written. The test of internal criticism or internal validity is the test of determining whether or not the documents in question have a sufficient ground in themselves to be taken at face value. What do the documents themselves claim to be? Here, the criterion employed is a criterion which was set out in formal terms by Aristotle in his Poetics, but which has been used in the entire history of historical literary criticism since, and has been expressed by many people. It's the following test, namely, that a document is taken to mean what it appears to mean unless there is good reason to take it otherwise. This is the literary application of that philosophical rule that I've cited in previous classes, that if a thing looks like an onion, tastes like an onion, and smells like an onion, it just might be an onion. If a document tastes, appears, and smells to have been written by a one-eyed plumber, then you assume that it was not written by a one-legged carpenter. The third test, the external test, has to do with whether or not there is material extrinsic to the document in question on the basis of which you can support and validate what it's saying internally. Now the question in the case of the New Testament documents is, first of all, are these documents as we have them today accurate representations of the documents as they were originally written? Then, secondly, were these documents written by people who had personal contact with Christ, with Jesus, or by people who had immediate contact with his followers? If the documents have that particular source, then these documents can be regarded as primary documents. And naturally, the internal and the external tests will determine the question of authorship and provenance. All right, let's begin with a bibliographical test. How good are these documents bibliographically? Toward the beginning of this course, I handed out a single sheet representing a quotation by Sir Frederick Kenyon. Kenyon, to the time of his death, in 1946, was the principal librarian of the British Museum and the foremost living specialist in textual criticism, in the documentary tradition by which texts reach us. Kenyon worked particularly on the New Testament documents, though his work was not at all limited to the New Testament documents. He was not a theologian. He was concerned with comparing the New Testament documents as to validity with other materials and in determining whether or not the textual results correspond to the original documents. Kenyon had this to say early in his career as he was working on the material. Quote, "In no other case, in comparison with the New Testament materials, in no other case is the interval of time between the composition of the book and the date of the earliest extant manuscript so short as in that of the New Testament. The books of the New Testament were written in the latter part of the first century. The earliest extant manuscripts, trifling scraps excepted," now this was early in his career, "are of the 4th century, say from 250 to 300 years later. This may sound a considerable interval, but it is nothing to that which parts most of the great classical authors from their earliest manuscripts. We believe that we have in all essentials an accurate text of the 7 extant plays of Sophocles. Yet the earliest substantial manuscript upon which it is based was written more than 1,400 years after the poet's death. Aeschylus, Aristophanes, and Thucydides are in the same state, while with Euripides the interval is increased to 1,600 years. For Plato it may be put at 1,300 years, for Demosthenes as low as 1,200. Now Kenyon is here comparing the New Testament documents with other documents of classical antiquity. He points out that 1,300 years separate the texts of Plato from the writing of these texts, whereas in the case of the New Testament materials, 250 to 300 years provide the separation. This was written prior to the papyrus discoveries that have taken place in the last 25 years. And shortly before his death, Kenyon wrote this in light of the papyri discoveries, which have bridged this 250 to 300 year gap. Quote, "The interval between the dates of original composition of these New Testament documents and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be in fact negligible, and the last foundation for any doubt that the New Testament scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity," and he underlines it, "and the general integrity," and he underscores that, "of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established." Unquote. This means that if one wants to argue that the New Testament materials as we have them today do not represent what was originally written, one has to say that not a single document of classical antiquity has any textual reliability, because the textual reliability of comparative ancient documents is in so much less attractive a condition as the New Testament documents, as compared to the New Testament documents. Now, what about the internal test? The internal test. These documents claim to have been written by eyewitnesses of the events, or by people who had immediate contact with the eyewitnesses. Take, for example, the preface to the third gospel. This is the gospel which was written by Luke, who was a physician and the companion of Paul. This is how the gospel according to Luke begins. Quote, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses, It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. Classical historians parallel this paragraph with Thucydides, especially, and to some extent with Herodotus. This particular affirmation of accuracy, the following of eyewitness evidence, and indeed the Greek style, is considered to be a close parallel to what is being done by the Greek historians. The fourth gospel, the gospel according to John, claims again and again to have been written by an eyewitness, one who was a witness to the resurrection of Christ, for example. Now, it's always possible that a document can be forged, or that it can be written by somebody who has been drinking heavily, or who is for some reason or another attempting to fool people. Therefore, external evidence is important as well. Are there external evidences that these materials were actually written by the people that they claim to have been written by? The answer to this is again yes. And the external evidences are so much stronger than the external evidences present in the case of comparative ancient documents that here again we find ourselves in a position where if we toss this out, we have the problem of what we're going to do with the other materials. Let's take, for example, this fourth gospel, the gospel according to John, which is the latest of the four gospels. We have the testimony of two people who knew John personally. One of them was a gentleman by the name of Papias, who lived in the city of Hierapolis around 130 AD, and he was a student of the Apostle John, studied under him, and John informed him of his own authorship of the fourth gospel, and also concerning the authorship of the other three gospels, that the first gospel was written by Matthew, who was an apostle, a disciple of Christ, that the second gospel was written by John Mark, of Roman background, a person who accompanied Peter, the apostle, and that the third gospel was written by Luke, the physician, who was a companion of the apostle Paul. We have parallel, independent testimony from another early second century person, Polycarp, who lived in Smyrna and was martyred about 156 AD for his Christian convictions. Both of these people were disciples, students of John. Now, these are only some of the points of external evidence, but the point is that the internal claims of these documents are supported by external evidence. They don't stand solely by themselves. As a result of these three lines of historical attestation, the conclusion has been reached by practically everybody at the present time, regardless of his religious conviction, that the New Testament materials were written within the generation of Christ's death and, according to the records, his resurrection. For example, you'll find that the first letter of Paul to the Corinthians is dated by practically everybody at AD 56. In this letter, in the 15th chapter, there is a list of the people who had immediate contact with the resurrected Christ. First of all, Paul states what the gospel is, the good news, that Jesus was God, and that he died for men's sins, and that he rose again from the dead. And then he cites various people who saw this, and either running out of time, running out of space, or whatever, he says simply, and to over 500 other people, most of whom remain alive to the present time. The implication is, if you don't happen to like the list I've given you. You can easily find other people who saw this. This, then, in relation to the death of Christ, is in circulation 26 years thereafter, and the gospel materials, which you were just referring to, come into the picture at about this time as well. The Gospel of Mark is the earliest gospel. Then we have Matthew, Luke, and John. The latest date that can possibly be given for John's gospel is 95, because we have papyrus fragments that date from 95, as far away from the place of composition, Ephesus, as Egypt. Luke's gospel was written prior to the death of Paul, and Paul's death occurred in the Neronian persecution in 65. So Luke's gospel is pre-65. Matthew precedes Luke, and Mark precedes Matthew. Now, the lines of evidence on the basis of which this ordering is given, I can't go into here, but you can easily get at it through some of the materials that I've provided in the course or that you've picked up. But this means that these materials are pushed back right on top of the time of Jesus' ministry and his death. And most important, this stuff was in circulation while people like these 500, well, the majority of them, were still alive, and when hostile witnesses to the whole business were still alive. F.F. Bruce of the University of Manchester has emphasized that the existence of hostile witnesses while this evidence was in circulation is the best evidence for its validity. Nobody is going to circulate stories like this in contact with people that would just love to smash the whole thing, and who obviously could have done so if what was being presented wasn't true. For example, when this evidence of the resurrection is presented, when the accounts of the resurrection are given in these Gospels, if this hadn't actually occurred, then those who wanted to smash this position, and there were plenty that did, could have easily wiped out the whole thing. And in the presentation of this material, the early preachers of the gospel went to the most difficult situations. They went immediately to the centers of the religious opposition in their communities, where if there had been counter-evidence, this counter-evidence certainly would have been brought to bear and the whole business eliminated. What we have here, then, is a remarkable case for the validity of the picture of Jesus that we get in these documents. You may be interested in a few lines from a specialist in Roman law who has recently been dealing with this question of the validity of the New Testament documents. This is an Englishman by the name of Sherwin White. Those of you who have my book, Where Is History Going, will find this quotation in the book. Sherwin White delivered the Sarum Lectures at Oxford in 1963, and these were published by the University of London under the title Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament. And at one point he gets into this question of the validity of this stuff, and this is what he has to say. Quote, "It is astonishing that while Greco-Roman historians have been growing in confidence, the 20th century study of the gospel narratives," he's referring here to the study of them by some theologians, "starting from no less promising material, has taken so gloomy a turn that some exponents apparently maintain that the historical Christ is unknowable and the history of his mission cannot be written. This seems very curious." That's a typical British expression. "This seems very curious." What he means here is crazy. "This seems very curious when one compares the case for the best-known contemporary of Christ, who, like Christ, is a well-documented figure, Tiberius Caesar. The story of his reign is known from four sources." Compare the four Gospels. "The annals of Tacitus and the biography of Suetonius, written some 80 or 90 years later, the brief contemporary record of Velleius Paterculus, and the 3rd century history of Cassius Dio. These disagree among themselves in the wildest possible fashion, both in matters of political action or motive, and in specific details of minor events. Everyone would admit that Tacitus is the best of all the sources, and yet no serious modern historian would accept at face value the majority of the statements of Tacitus about the motives of Tiberius. Now, the reason for this is that Tacitus couldn't stand emperors, therefore, anytime he has an opportunity to say something nasty about an emperor, he does so. But, Sherwin-White continues, this does not prevent the belief that the material of Tacitus can be used to write a history of Tiberius. Now, his point here is that if we're willing to write a history of Tiberius on the basis of evidence of this kind, then why is there hesitation when it comes to the picture of Jesus, which is attested by so much better materials that are not in this kind of contradictory state, nor are they materials based upon what somebody said, somebody said, somebody said on the subject? John Updike, who's novel Couples might have given you the idea that the fellow was not exactly a theologian, is nonetheless a writer whose concern with matters theological is quite great. And Updike did a poem on the resurrection of Christ which grows out of the kind of evidence that we've talked about here. And I think it's worthwhile my quoting this. Make no mistake, if he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules re-knit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. It was not as the flowers, each soft spring recurrent. It was not as his spirit in the mouths and fuddled eyes of 11 apostles. It was as his flesh, ours. The same hinged thumbs and toes, the same valved heart that pierced, died, withered, paused, and then regathered out of enduring might new strength to enclose. Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping, making of the event a parable, a sign painted in the faded credulity of earlier ages. Let us walk through the door. The stone is rolled back, not papier-mâché, not stone in a story, but the vast rock of materiality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. And if we will have an angel at the tomb, make it a real angel, weighty with Max Planck's quanta, vivid with hair, opaque in the dawn light, robed in real linen, spun on a definite loom. Let us not seek to make it less monstrous, for our own convenience, our own sense of beauty, lest, awakened in one unthinkable hour, we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance. Now, what Updike has done there is to take seriously the historicity, the materiality of this whole business. And he sees quite well, as poets are prone to do, that contact with objective fact does not remove from personal experience. It's just the other way around. There's nothing more dangerous in the world than the kind of faith, or rather credulity, as he puts it, that floats in midair. The case for the Christian philosophy of history is founded directly upon historical reality. The stone was not papier-mâché, and the body that came forth was a real one, and it was the one that made the claim earlier and at the time of the resurrection that the eternal destiny of people depends directly upon their relationship with him. Now, this may be wrong, But it had jolly well better be checked out to make sure that it is wrong. Because if it's right, then a great deal depends upon it. One's philosophy of history depends upon it, and as we pointed out in previous sessions, one's philosophy of history is a special case of one's general philosophy of life. So, one's total orientation is going to depend upon this. Well, what exactly was the message that Jesus presented? In some church environments these days, you get the impression that Jesus was a kind of epitomal do-gooder who went around doing nice things for people who didn't want to have nice things done to them. And probably there are no more objectionable people on earth, you know, than those who insist upon doing good to you whether you like it or not. The picture, however, that you get of Jesus in these documents is of a person who was absolutely convinced that he was no less than God come to earth. You find this in the earliest of the Gospels. You find it in the latest of the Gospels. It's impossible to find any development of simple humanity and do-goodishness onto deity here. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus performs the same miracles that he performs in the Gospel of John. He forgives sin. Hardly does the Gospel of Mark open, but Jesus is telling a fellow, your sins are forgiven. And the religious leaders standing around say, who can forgive sin but God only? Jesus doesn't say, oops, you're quite right, it was a slip of the tongue, I really didn't mean that. What I meant was God in heaven will forgive his sins. Jesus said that you may know that I have the power to forgive sins. Take up your bed and walk. And the fellow did. The picture that Jesus gives is of God come to earth, and the purpose of this, and again, you find this in the Gospel of Mark just as readily as you do in the other Gospels, the purpose is to give his life as a ransom for many. As a ransom, paying back a debt. Jesus claimed to be taking the evils of the world on himself as a substitutionary sacrifice, as a fulfillment of the Old Testament sacrificial system. And in doing this, he claimed it would be possible for any person who came into a relationship with him to be freed from this burden. And he based the validity of these claims on the forthcoming resurrection. He said, tear down this temple, and in 3 days I will build it again. And after they had torn down that temple, after they had killed him, he rose again from the dead. And the text says that people believed on him after they had seen this happen. The case for the Christian philosophy of history, then, depends squarely on this person. You can't talk about the Christian philosophy of history apart from the historical question of who Jesus was. And I suggest that this question is answerable historically, and that if we're willing to face this kind of evidence, it's going to have a tremendous impact on our own decision as to philosophy of life. I'm going to open up the session early tonight for questions, because this is a very key unit in everything that we're doing, and we want to make sure that it's possible to thrash out objections to this and questions dealing with it. However, I would appreciate it if the miracle issue, that is, you know, can miracles occur or not, which is a philosophical question, or can be dealt with as a philosophical question, could be postponed until next week when we're going to go into this in more detail.